I'm Karen Hartglass, and it's time for It's All About Food here on a hot July 8th, 2014. How are you today? Let's see. We've got a really, really big shoe for you today. I just felt like saying it like that. We have a great show. And let's bring on the first guest, Jeffrey Cohen. He's the Executive Director of Jewish Vegetarians of North America, an international organization which encourages and helps Jews to embrace plant-based diets as an expression of the Jewish values of compassion for animals, concern for health, and care for the environment. He's also the author of The Beet Eating Hebe, the leading blog on theology of veganism. Welcome to It's All About Food, Jeffrey.
Hey, Karen, great to be with you. Not quite as good as being with you and Gary in New York as we were a couple months ago, but this is the next best of it.
Yeah, I'm so glad we got to meet at one of my favorite vegan restaurants, Simple Veg, in my neighborhood in Queens, which just really opened in February, and I'm glad we were able to meet there, and I want them to survive and thrive.
Me too, and it's great to see the growing number of vegan restaurants and vegan food products in our stores. So I would say the future looks bright for that restaurant and vegan restaurants all around the country.
Right. The future, we have to say it looks bright because it feels good, and we'll just see what happens next.
Well, I'm not just saying that because I know this isn't the topic of our conversation today, but in real economic statistics,
yes,
the number of vegan establishments and vegan products available in the marketplace today is growing exponentially. It's really remarkable.
Now, let's talk about the Jewish Vegetarians of North America. Now, you are the new executive director.
Right. Also the first executive director.
New and the first. Groundbreaking. Okay, so how come all these changes took place, and what can we expect?
Well, the organization has been around for about 40 years, but up until a couple of years ago, it was strictly a volunteer-run organization. And they actually did some amazing things, considering they didn't have any professional staff or any serious fundraising going on. But about 2 years ago, I was working for the Jewish Federation, which is a big Jewish organization, and gaining a master's in public management in grad school. And when I found out about JVNA, between the tools I was getting in grad school and the knowledge I was gaining about the Jewish landscape, it occurred to me that the time was right for JVNA to become much more than it was and to have much greater capacity to get the message out.
Okay.
So that, in a nutshell, is the story.
It's a good one. Well, the time is right, and I'm hearing that all over the place with a lot of different organizations. And we have to thank a lot of people that have come before us who have been working so hard as activists for so long without the Internet, trying to be heard. And Richard Schwartz, of course, is one of them who I've had on the program a number of times. And he's part of the Jewish Vegetarians of North America.
Yes, he is. And when you're talking about Richard Schwartz, you should probably mention in the same breath Alex Hershaft.
Oh, Alex Hershaft. Okay.
Who was also on our board of directors and is actually the first person to organize an organization devoted to farm animal advocacy.
Oh, now look at that. I didn't know that.
Yeah, he's a real pioneer. And he's going very strong, thank God, at age 80. As is Richard.
Right. Well, his organization, the Farm Animal Reform Movement, has been spearheading the two animal rights conferences on both coasts, the East Coast in Washington, D.C., and in Los Angeles.
Right. In fact, I'm leaving for Los Angeles tomorrow to speak at that conference.
Oh, great. Okay. So I'm always looking for any group that finds reasons to stop killing animals. So from a religious perspective, and I always like to say I'm not a religious person, although I was raised in a Jewish background, but I respect anybody who wants to promote plant foods. And, you know, we had Steve Kaufman on recently talking about the Christian Vegetarian Association, and I know from talking a little bit with Richard Schwartz about Jewish Vegetarians in North America, some things about why, from a, from a Jewish perspective, from Jewish values, why plant-based diets are important. So maybe you could touch on that a little bit.
Sure. And actually, Garen, if you're a rabbi, your Sunday school teacher had taught you what the Torah actually says about these issues, you might be a religious person today. I actually mean that quite sincerely, because a large number of Jewish vegans and vegetarians feel a bit disaffected because they don't feel the religion really embraces them,
mm-hmm.
which is really crazy, because the Torah, which is what we call the Bible, not only explicitly directs us to adopt a plant-based diet, at virtually every turn where the subject comes up, it casts meat-eating in a very negative light. So we're on a very solid theological footing.
I've heard people say that the Bible or the Torah commands them to eat meat, that they're supposed to eat meat.
No, actually, I would almost say just the opposite. It is true that the Bible, unfortunately, does permit meat eating. But in the places where it does permit meat eating, it makes it very clear this is not God's preference or God's will. This is God making a concession to human lust. So it, by no means is meat eating ever presented as an ethical act or as an ideal in the Torah, which is why, Karen, that so many leading rabbis, both in the United States, Europe, and Israel, that's actually one more than both, and all of these places, endorse vegetarianism or veganism as a Jewish ideal.
Hmm. But it's not the majority. It's just a handful of them.
Well, no, I would say, Rabbi Jonathan Sachs, who just resigned, just retired as chief rabbi of Great Britain, Rabbi David Rosen, who was a chief rabbi of Ireland. Mm-hmm. Tomorrow, in fact, I'm meeting with Rabbi David Wolpe in Los Angeles, who is on our rabbinic council, who was named by Newsweek to be the most influential rabbi in America. I'm talking about people like Rabbi Rav Cook, who was the chief rabbi of pre-state Israel in the early 20th century, along with all of his disciples.
Mm.
So this is not some marginal fringe idea in Judaism. This is an idea endorsed by many top rabbis.
Okay. Now, are all these guys that you mentioned, are they vegetarian? Or they just
Yeah, no, all the guys I mentioned are either vegetarian or vegan. Yes.
Okay. Well, yeah, you're not in the circles that I've been. Meat has always been a tradition. Pastrami, corned beef, brisket. How could you be Jewish and not eat those foods?
Well, I would say two things about that. If you go to our website, jewishveg.com, you will see meat-free versions of most of those foods, if not all of them. I know you have a great recipe for vegan gefilte fish.
Yes.
I never liked, even when I was a meat eater, real gefilte fish, but...
yeah, it's kind of funny.
I saw your recipe in the San Diego Jewish Journal right next to an article, a beautiful spread on our organization in the San Diego Jewish Journal.
Yeah, I was excited that they found out about both of us.
And you know what's so cool, Karen? If you were to go to the website of the San Diego Jewish Journal, I confess I haven't checked today, but it's probably still the case because this is the most recent issue. The top item on the homepage where your eye immediately goes to is the article about us that says, should Jews be vegetarians?
Mm.
So the word is getting out.
Yes. Well, like I said before, any angle, any group, it's important. And, I don't know, did you know Rin Barry?
I didn't know him personally. I was just at Summerfest, and there was a beautiful memorial service for him there.
Oh, yeah. Well, he wrote quite a bit about religions and how he believed, from what he had researched, that they all started out with a vegetarian premise.
No, in fact, there was no rabbi today or ever who would dispute that. The first thing God says to human beings is, you will eat a plant-based diet, Genesis 1:29.
Mm-hmm.
So there is no dispute among rabbis that the original plan was to be, if the word existed back then, they would have said vegan.
But we're imperfect, and we got off the path.
Right, and here is the issue. There's a number of causes for that, and of course it's something in my job I've had to think about very deeply. But the number one reason is this, Karen. Let's face it. Everybody in our society is bombarded every day, almost 360 degrees, by pro-meat messages.
Yep.
It's in the media. It's in our institutions. It's in our schools, our workplaces, even our homes often. So rabbis, believe it or not, are people too. And they're susceptible to the same bombardment of messaging.
Right.
And but fortunately, many leading rabbis have overcome that and stuck to what the Torah actually instructs us to do.
All right, let's just talk for a minute about the eating heeb. And as I mentioned in one of our last emails, I didn't realize that you were the beet-eating heeb.
My alter ego.
Who is the beet-eating heeb?
Well, the beet-eating heeb is it's a blog persona I created, and it all started with my own vegetarian journey, if I can describe that in a minute. Which is, my wife and I actually became vegetarians because we were sitting in the synagogue on Rosh Hashanah 7 years ago, and they were reading the creation story, the first chapter of Genesis, and when they got to verse 29, and it says, you will eat a plant-based diet, in so many words, we looked at each other and said, we're supposed to be vegetarians. And just like that, we did it. And then I started wondering, well, why aren't all Jews vegetarians if this is what it says? So I started looking into the rest of the Torah, the rest of the Torah. It is kind of a story. And what I found is, yeah, that actually is the consistent thrust of the Torah's ethical message, that we're supposed to have a plant-based diet, and meat eating, you can do it, but God would really prefer we don't. So I started a blog to disseminate what I was finding in my own reading of the Torah and my own study of what other rabbinic scholars were saying. And that is, the Beet Eating Heeb is going strong today.
Yeah, I'm reading your last post, which where someone asked you if there was a blessing for kale.
Yeah, and that's the amazing thing. There's blessings for vegetables, there's blessings for fruit, there's blessings for wine, there's blessing for bread. But where is the blessing for meat?
Right.
There is no blessing for meat.
Mm-hmm. That's an odd thing. And
well,
even the Indians had some sort of grace that they would say, thanking the god for the animal that they had hunted, and they were going to use every part of it.
Well, I will say this. The ritual slaughterer in Orthodox Judaism is sort of the Jewish version of the Native American hunter.
Mm.
And, of course, in theory, they do. There is some ritual and prayer associated with that, with what they do. But the reality is, because meat consumption has increased so much, ritual slaughter in Judaism has become industrialized, like the rest of animal agriculture. So the slaughter is occurring at speeds and at quantities that make it impossible to bring the original intention to
the
act.
Let's talk about kosher for a
sure.
moment. So just tell us briefly what it is and how perhaps it isn't quite what it's supposed to be.
Yeah, thank you, Karen, it's an important topic. The laws of kashrut, as they're called, actually imply very strongly that there's some moral problem with meat eating, right? Because
yep.
in Jewish law, you can eat any fruit, you can eat any vegetable, you can eat any grain. But when it comes to meat, there are severe restrictions placed on not only what animals you can eat, but on mixing meat and dairy products. So right there, there's a very vivid distinction between meat and the rest of the food that we're actually supposed to eat.
I remember as a child learning that we weren't supposed to mix or in the same meal the milk from the mother with the flesh of the child or something. It was
right.
kind of poetic like that, but when you think about it, it's like gulp.
Right. The laws of kashrut, one or both of what I'm about to say are true. there's no doubt that the laws of kashrut make it difficult, as we say in Judaism, a pain in the tuchus, to eat meat, right? You mm-hmm. have to have separate dishes, separate, in often cases, separate sinks, kitchen appliances. You can only get your meat at a certain store. You have to time it carefully so you're not eating meat too close to eating dairy. It's actually a pain. People adapt to it, but it's a pain, and it was meant to be a pain. It's also understood by many rabbis, including some of the ones I named a few minutes ago, that the laws of kashrut were designed to wean Jews off meat altogether and to get back to the ideal of Genesis 1:29.
Wow.
And in case you doubt that, when God was in control of what the Jews were eating, which was the case when they were in the desert after leaving Egypt and before getting to Israel, when God was in control, they were on a vegan diet.
Right.
Manna.
Manna from heaven was...
Right. So
what was it?
It's described explicitly in the Torah as like coriander seed.
Wow.
So there's no dispute. It was a plant food.
They ate that for 40 years and nothing else?
Except for one story, which I think I might have shared with you when we had dinner a couple months ago.
Yeah.
I really commend your listeners to read Numbers chapter 11 in the Bible, which is a very dramatic story in the Bible that rabbis and ministers and Sunday school teachers tend to gloss over because it makes them very uncomfortable if they're a meat eater. But in Numbers 11, when a group of the Israelites in the desert complained about the manna and demanded meat, God gave them meat all right and then killed them in a plague. And if that message wasn't clear enough,
wow.
The Torah says they were buried in the graves of lust.
Wow.
So
history repeats itself.
Yep. No, it was certainly a precursor of the health issues that the standard American diet is producing today.
Mm-hmm. Whew. Now, we have these facilities today that are growing and then slaughtering animals that supposedly meet the kosher laws, which are not supposed to cause any pain and suffering, is my understanding.
Right. There's, yeah.
They seem to cause
well,
a bit.
Well, let me... as an organization, we do not support efforts to ban kosher slaughter, which has been attempted and actually done in a few European countries,
mm-hmm.
because really, kosher slaughter is no, these days, it's maybe no better, but it's no worse than conventional factory farming slaughter techniques.
Right, but it's a factory, yeah.
But one thing I want to stress to your listeners, because this is a common misconception about the kosher slaughter laws, those laws only apply to the last seconds of an animal's life. Anything that happened before, the animal's whole life in, you know, a combined animal feeding operation or, you know, a warehouse crammed with 50,000 chickens, none of those are governed by the laws of kashrut. The kashrut only applies to the slaughter, those last couple seconds. So for people to think that, well, this...
They're getting
kosher meat is more
meat.
Ethical.
Mm-hmm.
Try telling that to the animal.
Okay, well, that really is an important point. Huh, they lead a pretty horrific life, and then the last few minutes, they're killed one way or another.
Yes.
Huh, which brings us to delicious plant foods. Yay! Now, do you know what's been going on in Israel? With respect to vegetarianism?
Yeah, it's really amazing. And, of course, we use the example of Israel and to tell people, Jews in the United States, this is the example we should be following. The vegan movement, and specifically the vegan movement in Israel, is exploding. It's really an amazing thing to see. Even the prime minister, who is essentially a Republican, what we would think of as a Republican. They call it the Likud Party in Israel. The Prime Minister, Bibi Netanyahu, publicly endorsed Meatless Monday and said at home he's mostly vegetarian. Now, can you imagine President Obama doing that?
Oh, if
Unfortunately,
only.
No.
No. You know, I always wondered about some of the presidents and what they were eating. And because I know that his trainer for a while was a vegan. And so you just wonder, but it's just impossible for leaders to really even if they wanted to be vegan or wanted to promote a certain message that was not mainstream, it would be impossible.
Right, and frankly, the same thing applies to Pope Francis. I know a lot of people in the animal rights movement were very excited when Pope Francis became Pope because Francis was the patron saint of the animals. But he's also facing similar constraints. There's an awful lot of Catholics who are heavily invested in animal agriculture and factory farming. So you're never going to see Pope Francis endorse plant-based eating or seriously criticize what's happening in factory farming.
Well, I brought up Israel before because I think it's one place where it's easier than most to go vegetarian or vegan. And I think I told you this, but I was working for an Israeli company back in 1988, and I decided that when I was spending my 3 months in Israel on business, I would go vegan. And it was easy there. Because, number one, back then, and I'm sure it's still the same, everyone knew what was in the food. You know, here in the United States, people don't know how to prepare food. They don't know what's in their food. They just eat it. And they knew you could go to a dairy restaurant or you could go to a meat restaurant. So if I went to a meat restaurant and asked for something vegetarian, I knew there wasn't going to be dairy in it. Now, there wasn't a guarantee that an egg wouldn't be in it, but I was narrowing down the variabilities to go wrong. And people were very respectful of my requests. And it was always easy. You could live forever on hummus and ful and the Israeli salad and the Lebanese lentil salad. I mean, there were just so many different combinations of beans, grains, and vegetables.
Right, and don't
Fabulous.
Forget falafel, which is and really
falafel.
The national food.
That's right.
Made from chickpeas.
The original veggie burger.
Right, and you know, this actually does harken back to the Torah, Karen, because the seven sacred foods associated with Israel were all vegan.
And what are the seven sacred foods?
In multiple places in the Bible.
What are the seven sacred foods?
I was afraid
foods?
You were going to ask that. Let's see, I'm going to go in from memory here. Olives, dates, pomegranates, date honey, wheat, barley, and what am I forgetting?
Let's see.
I'm blanking on 6 out of 7.
It's pretty good.
Not bad. That's a B+.
Well, first of all, I love olives, especially good olives like the ones from Israel or Turkey where they know how to marinate the olives. I don't like the stuff like the smooth black olives we get in a can here in the United States. Feh. And then dates, and there are all different kinds of dates, but dates are a delicious food, and it's nature's candy. Making sweetening your dessert recipes with dates, well, date sugar, for example, which is just evaporated dates ground up, of all the sugars, it's the most nutritious sugar.
Right. In fact, at home, that's what we use as a sweetener in tea and anything else is exactly what you're talking about, date paste. It's simple to make, and it's a sweetener that amazingly is actually good for you.
Yeah, when people talk about sugar and they say, you know, what's the best sugar, I usually say all the sugars are the same, you know, cane sugar or corn syrup or honey. They're all really, they don't come with a lot of nutrition and they just come with a lot of sugar, maple syrup. They're all pretty much the same. But date sugar, when it's actually from the dates, it comes with a lot of bang with its sweetness. So that's really the top of the list there. I can see why that's one of the seven. Now, wheat and barley, I like them both, but for people who have celiac disease, that's problematic in today's society.
No, it
society.
Was not gluten-free.
It was not a gluten-free seven best foods. but no meat there. Right.
No, no meat or animal products of any kind.
Right. Okay, now, is a Jewish vegetarian, are you planning any events or
Yes, we actually, in Victoria Moran, I don't know if you've ever had her on her show.
I have, and I'm going to be on her show, I think, next week.
Oh, great. I'll
like
definitely
that.
Be listening to that. She actually gave us a great plug at Vegetarian Summerfest, which just wrapped up over the weekend in Johnstown, Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
And she called this event historic, and it truly is historic. There has never been an event like this in American history or possibly anywhere. The Holocaust Center of Pittsburgh, along with JVNA and the largest Jewish congregation, are co-sponsoring a program where Alex Hershaft, who I mentioned earlier, is going to talk about how his personal experience in the Warsaw Ghetto during the Holocaust led to him becoming an advocate for farm animals.
Wow.
So it's a very exciting event because as an organization, we really don't invoke analogies to the Holocaust because it creates a huge distraction when you do that.
Well,
so
that's what I was just going to ask you, because
yeah.
People don't like it when we say that the factory farming of animals today is like...
Right. And actually, when you really think about it, it's an imperfect analogy to begin with, because the Nazis were trying to wipe Jews out, whereas farmers are perpetuating farm animals. They're not trying to wipe farm animals out. So it's an imperfect analogy, but beside that, the bigger problem is when you... I really encourage veg advocates not to make analogies to the Holocaust, because it creates a distraction and distracts the listener from the point you're trying to make. Because so many people, especially Jews, but not just Jews, really react viscerally to that. However, Alex Hershaft is a Holocaust survivor.
So he
Nobody
can,
deny him his lived experience and how it affected him.
Wow.
So that's why we're so excited about it. We have found a legitimate, authentic way to... invoke the Holocaust for the sake of farm animals.
And when's this event going to be, and how do we find out?
This is going to be Monday, August 25th, Monday night, in Pittsburgh at Rodef Shalom. So anybody who is within, this would be worth driving several hours to attend. It's really going to be a historic event.
And is it on your website?
It will be soon. You know what? We just chose the name for the event today.
Oh, okay.
So Victoria heard me talk about it at another event, and we weren't intending to start marketing it just yet, but since Victoria gave it a nice plug, we're not going to wait any longer.
That sounds good. Okay. Well, I'll look forward to that. And the website that we're going to be looking for that information is
jewishveg.com,
where there is a lot of other information as well.
Right, because really, in the time we have today, Karen, we are just really scratching the surface of what the Torah has to say about these issues. But on our website, there's lots more information.
Great. Well, Jeffrey Cohen, thank you so much for joining me on It's All About Food, and I look forward to breaking bread with you again sometime soon.
I hope so, Karen. Thank you so much for having me on. Really enjoyed it.
Okay, me too. Take care, Jeffrey.
Okay, you too.
All right. Well, we have 2 minutes. 2 minutes left before we take a quick break. And you know what I'm going to do. I'm going to remind you about a few things. Number one, at ResponsibleEatingAndLiving.com, we are airing our 70-minute documentary, Preaching to the Fire. Now, I've heard comments from all around the world. It's been really inspiring. But I need you to watch it, and I need you to let me know what you think. My email is info@realmeals.org, info@realmeals.org. It's 70 minutes. It's free, and I think it's pretty inspiring. So I hope you do get a chance to watch it, and let me know about it. Let me know you watched it, and let me know what you think about it. Now, the other thing I wanted to mention, I talk about distilled water from time to time, and I'm a big proponent of the Aquany water distiller. I don't have an official date yet, but I'm working with the Aquany people to have a water webinar, and we will be getting all our questions answered about water and distilled water, and I know I have a lot. So if you're interested in that, I'll be talking about it at some point here on the show, but you could also send me an email, info@realmeals.org, and I will put you on the list for that. Okay. What else can I tell you about? My next guest who will be coming up in the second part of the show is Steve Wise, and this is going to be a really important moment. He's doing incredible work with the Non-Human Rights Project. He's got some cases here in New York trying to get rights for chimpanzees, and I'm really excited about it, and I'm really looking forward to speaking with him. Let's take a quick break, and we'll be right back. Hello, everybody. We're back. I'm Karen Hartglass, and thanks for joining me today. My next guest is Stephen Wise. He is the president of the Non-Human Rights Project. He holds a JD from Boston University Law School and a BS in chemistry from the College of William and Mary. He has practiced animal protection law for 30 years throughout the United States and is admitted to the Massachusetts Bar. And we're going to be talking a lot more about all of that right now. Welcome, Steve Wise. Thanks for being on the show again.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
I had you on about 5 years ago, and I have to tell you, I was so moved and impressed with your book that came out back then, The American Trilogy.
Yes.
And I love that book. I read a lot of books. I interview a lot of authors, and that's like my top all-time 10 list. It was an incredible
thank you
piece of work, and I'm sure not enough people really know about it or appreciate it.
Well,
but
you.
I tell everybody about it. And I loved what you were doing. And two of the things I want to focus on, one is one of the things you were doing in the book is connecting the dots between the way we treat humans and the way we treat animals. So maybe we could jump in right there and talk a little bit about that. I know a lot of people, when I talk about, my focus is food, and I'm always talking about eating plants and not animals, and a lot of responses are, you know, why don't you care about humans?
Ah, well, I guess the way I would respond to that is of course I care about humans, and you know, human rights, you know, are animal rights, and so I'm not sure if I've ever run into an animal rights lawyer who doesn't care about human rights. There's nothing that we're going to get for animals that, for non-human animals that humans don't already have. And so, part of my work has always been human rights work as well as non-human rights work. So it's hard for me sometimes to even understand the question, unless it's why don't you spend all of your time just working for humans and none of your time working for non-humans? And for that I say, well, there's an awful lot of people working on human problems, working how to solve human problems, working on human rights issues, and there's only a very small number of us who are working for a much larger population of non-human animals.
It's a reaction kind of statement when people don't really know what they're talking about.
That could
basically
be. And then, of course, sometimes I then say, well, exactly what are you doing for humans? And usually I don't find that they're doing too much.
Exactly. And the other thing is we live in this hierarchical society, and when you want to get benefits for animals, or like in your book, American Trilogy, you compared the way we treated human slaves in this country to the way we treat animals in that region in North Carolina, Tar Heel, and people get offended when you compare pigs with African Americans.
Well, I'm really comparing the way we treat those who are legal things, those who who our legal system doesn't recognize as having the capacity for even a single legal right, and that when we treat them as things, then part of what happens is that they are seen as not existing for themselves, but are seen as existing solely for the sake of us legal persons who have the capacity for rights, and one of the rights we have is really the right to own and control them. And so what I'm not comparing pigs to African American slaves. I'm simply saying that within that category, there have been a lot of beings who have been within the category of legal things, and that one by one, Western law certainly has over the centuries begin to remove entities from the category of legal thing. And one of the most prominent, you know, in long struggles was the struggle for blacks, whether it was in the U.S. or South America or England, and it was a long struggle to end human slavery, and not just for black chattel slavery, but Arab slavery. You know, there's all sorts of slaveries that were
no, sure. Well, women for a long time were considered as property too, and still
were struggling with that. Handicapped people, you know, people who are deaf, children, and so it's kind of a long process, and it just so happens that there's a lot of cases around law cases around the legal issue of black slaves, both in England and in the U.S., where black slaves were once in the same place where non-human slaves are now, and so we look to that kind of law.
Mm-hmm. All right. I think it was in the beginning of this year when your work came to my attention again. I was reading the New York Times, and I found out about the cases you have going on in New York, and I was so excited to read them. And let's focus on that now. You're getting a lot of attention, and this is exciting work.
Well, the Non-Human Rights Project has been focusing on trying to figure out how to solve the problem of right now. You know, all but only human beings are seen as legal persons. They're seen as having the capacity for one or more legal rights. But on the other side of that wall, is the rest of the animal creation. And we think that's an entirely arbitrary line, and that there are many non-human animals, and we're willing to have the courts deal with them one by one. But there are many non-human animals who we think are entitled to legal personhood, that is, the capacity for one or more rights. Then we'd like to be able to struggle to find out which rights courts and others think that different sorts of non-human animals should have. And it all depends upon what sort of beings, you know, each kind of animal is. And so the Non-Human Rights Project is now we estimate about 30,000 hours preparing for these first cases from 2007 until 2013, and we filed three requests that judges issue writs of habeas corpus in the lowest courts of New York, which are the Supreme Courts, on behalf of four captive chimpanzees who were all the chimpanzees that were still alive, as far as we knew, within the state of New York. When we decided to file suit on behalf of chimpanzees in New York in March of 2013, there were seven of them, and three of them died just in the 9 months before we were able to file our first suits in December of 2013. And what we've been doing is the courts refused to issue the writs of habeas corpus, which is what we expected they would do. But we thought we ought to file the cases in the lower courts and then begin to move our way through the appellate courts of New York and begin to introduce the appellate judges of New York and also the public and the judges and the lawyers and the legal profession throughout the United States and throughout the world to the arguments that we are making, which we think are very powerful. And you can see them. We post all of our legal papers and the judicial decisions on our website, which is www.nonhumanrights.org. You can see the petition for the writ of habeas corpus that we filed. You can see that we filed 100 pages of affidavits of nine very respected ape cognition experts from all over the world, from Japan and Sweden and Germany and Scotland and England and the U.S. You can see the 80-page memorandum of law we filed in each case. You can see transcripts of the arguments we made in court. You can see what the judges did, what our briefs are to the appellate courts, and you can kind of follow the whole process along with us.
Now, for us layman folks out here, habeas corpus is getting relief from unlawful imprisonment.
Yes. Habeas corpus really means produce the body, and it's oftentimes called the great writ. It's seen as the most fundamental sort of right that we have, which is the right to bodily liberty, because we argue that is a protection of our autonomy, that autonomy, it really lies at the basis of our personhood and as well as bodily liberty. And so when someone is unlawfully imprisoned, you can use the common law and sometimes the statutory writ of habeas corpus to make the person who's imprisoning you, you know, produce your body and give a legally sufficient reason for imprisoning you. And that's what we've done on behalf of all the chimpanzees. The book that I wrote before, an American trilogy, was called Though the Heavens May Fall, and it was really part of the work that I was doing for the Non-Human Rights Project, and it told the story of a black slave named James Somerset, who had been kidnapped in Africa, sold as a slave in Virginia, and eventually taken to London. And the very widely publicized case in which his lawyers had brought a common law writ of habeas corpus on his behalf, and that Lord Mansfield, who was Chief Justice of the Court of King's Bench in London, had finally ruled that slavery was so odious that the common law would not support it and ordered him freed. And that book, Though the Heavens May Fall, was really a blueprint for what the Non-Human Rights Project was already working on, and a metaphor as well.
Well, I love what you're doing, but I mean, I can imagine what judges are thinking when they see this come across their desk. Like, what am I going to do with this? And I want you to be successful, but when you are successful, what does that mean for chimpanzees and other animals?
Well, I think the first time in which we will be successful, and we will. But we don't know whether it's going to be these first cases, they're going to be their fifth or tenth or a hundredth. We simply don't know. But we think our arguments are very powerful, and that it's almost impossible, or it is impossible, to rule against us without being rather arbitrary and without undermining the values that the judges say that they indeed believe in. And so, but we also understand that it's a novel issue, and that many judges will not have ever thought about this.
Right.
And we need to have them be able to take the time to really think about it, to test our arguments, to discuss them, to give people chances to write law review articles, to have them taught in, to have what we're doing taught in law schools. And we understand that judges may not want to stick their neck out for the first time or the fifth time or the tenth time, but eventually they will see that we are making arguments from justice, and that these sorts of arguments have been made before and successfully, and there's no reason why this line that separates all humans from all non-humans should be where it is, and it needs to be moved, and we begin to need to litigate where that line should be, even temporarily, what animals, based on current scientific knowledge, ought to be legal persons with the capacity to have one or more rights. And that's really the first step in what's going to be a long struggle. So for me, I've been working for 29 years just to prepare for the first step. And it's taken a long, long time, but I think the world is ready now to take the first step. I think we have thought about the issue, debated the issue, thoroughly researched the issue, and although it took us a long, long time, we now think we're ready to go, and we've already taken the first steps in what is going to be, you know, a long strategic litigation campaign.
So what would we not be able to do with chimpanzees that we're doing today?
Well, if you are a legal person, that means you have the capacity for, you know, one or more rights. So the question is, which rights then are going to be recognized? And so the one that we're looking to is bodily liberty, that you could not imprison a chimpanzee. So if a if a judge recognized that a chimpanzee, because she is an autonomous being, has a fundamental right to bodily liberty in the way that we do, then you could no more imprison her than you could imprison me.
Mm-hmm. So that means no vivisection on chimpanzees.
Well, unless you could do it without imprisoning them. Bodily integrity is another issue, but mm-hmm. I think it's a closely related one. And I think essentially the chimpanzees would be moved to a sanctuary in which mm-hmm. they would be able to live out the rest of their lives.
Oh, wouldn't that be nice?
With other chimpanzees, mm-hmm. and in a way that approximates as best as we can the way they would be living in the wild in Africa. And so part of our case was to bring in the North American Primate Sanctuary Alliance, which has a series of sanctuaries, and they all agreed that any chimpanzees who were freed pursuant to our writ of habeas corpus would then be evaluated by the folks at the North American Primate Sanctuary Alliance and then placed in the appropriate sanctuary where mm-hmm. they would live out the rest of their lives with other chimpanzees in the best possible way for each of them.
Now, I'm sure people are thinking, okay, we give chimpanzees their rights. You're opening a can of worms. Who's next after that?
Well, we're about ready to file suit on behalf of elephants.
Oh, so, they need so much help.
Elephants are
before
are next.
They're extinct.
We are looking at, let's see, let me see how the best way of explaining this is that our argument is that autonomy is a fundamental value in Western law. And the reason that we think it is that judges say it is, and legislators mm-hmm. say it is, and people who write treaties say it is. So what we're saying is that we believe what you're telling us, that the protection of autonomy is a supreme value in Western law. Now, we're going to show you some non-human animals who have autonomy, and they should be also protected in the same way we are. And right now, we know that the scientific evidence shows that all four species of apes are bonobos and chimpanzees and orangutans and gorillas, that the two species of elephants are African and Asian, that certain cetaceans are, orcas, other whales and dolphins, perhaps such animals as African gray parrots. And we say you have to follow the science, before we ever file a lawsuit, we bring in, as we did in the chimpanzee cases, there we brought in 100 pages of affidavits setting out what the latest science is showing that these beings, that these chimpanzees are indeed autonomous. And we're going to do the same thing for elephants. We do the same thing for orcas. And then that's where it goes. We are beginning at least with those animals that we think that we have very strong scientific evidence that they are autonomous beings and that their autonomy should therefore be protected.
How did you choose New York for your case?
We spent 6 years going through. We came up with about 60 different legal issues, and we ran them through all 50 states. So we had to make about 3,000 separate legal judgments as to how we might rank the states on each of the legal issues. And then we kind of sat back and looked at all of them. And October or November of 2012, we narrowed it down to, I think, either 6 or 10. And then we met on Easter Day in 2013, and we narrowed those down to 1. I think there are 5 or 6 that we feel are very close to each other. And but New York, for one reason or another, we thought was going to be the best. But one thing also is once we narrowed the states down, we then turned to our science folks and said, which of these kinds of animals actually live there? Are there chimpanzees? Are there apes in these states? Are there elephants in these states? Are there cetaceans in these states? So we thought we wanted to begin with chimpanzees, and there were some states that we were very interested in that simply didn't have any captive chimpanzees, so we decided to hold them back for orcas or elephants or something like that. So New York was the very, we thought, was the, potentially the most favorable state that had chimpanzees.
Yay, New York. Well, I hope they act fast and act on the right side.
Well, we want them to act on the right side. We don't care so much about speed right now.
Mm-hmm.
We are, I've been in this for a long, long, almost 30 years. I've been preparing for this, and we are, you know, in order to just get the first suits filed, and now we know we're on a decades-long struggle afterwards. But we are pushing as hard as we can. You know, as much money as we can raise, we're then using it to...
That was my next question. Who's funding this? This is a tremendous amount of work.
Well, we have to get donors who will give us money for staff attorneys, for office help, you know, for fundraisers, for social media folks, for science folks. So we don't want to get ahead of ourselves, and we are filing those suits that we think we can afford. And as more money comes in, we're bringing more people on. What really helped, I don't know if you're even aware of it, but we were the cover story for the Sunday New York Times magazine in April 28th. So that brought us, you know, a huge amount of attention worldwide, and it still is.
Oh, that's great.
One of the things is that donors are coming forward and saying, I didn't know you existed.
Right.
What can we do for you? We'll say, well, I know what you can do for us. And I go up and give them our budget and say, would you like to fund this position or that position? We can file these suits or those suits. And so that's what we do. We're a 501c3, and we ask people who believe in what we're doing and think that we're competent to give us the funds to do our job.
That's great. And the last thing I wanted to ask you or talk about is you're flying all around the world teaching young lawyers about animal law.
I am doing that. Not only am I teaching young lawyers, but I'm also the Non-Human Rights Project is also reaching out to legal organizations and lawyers right now in 7 other countries, and we're trying to work with them so that they can do the same or similar things as we're doing in the United States and their countries. So we're working with folks, and I visit all these folks and I give talks there. In Brazil, in Argentina, in Spain, in Portugal, in the UK, France and Switzerland. And so I've been spending a lot of time going back and forth. I also teach there as well. And in fact, I'm leaving for Barcelona, Spain tomorrow afternoon. And I was just there 5 weeks ago, so
that's a long trip.
There's a lot I know, and when I come back, and then I'm going to Sweden, and
oh my goodness,
3 weeks after that. So I'm going. I think in a span of 4 months, I'm taking 4 trips to Europe and 2 to South America. So
well, the good news is that you're planting seeds, and people are nourishing them so that
they
grow.
Are very interested all over the world in
that's
what we're doing,
exciting.
And they're inviting us to come. And when we tell them that we'd like to work with them to try to reproduce the same thing in their country, they are leaping at the opportunity. We are very, very pleased.
Okay, well, I was so excited to see you in the New York Times, and I'm glad that they printed it because they don't print a lot of things that I like.
Well, Charles Siebert, you know, wrote the article. He did a fantastic job. He worked on it for 2 or 3 years. And, you know, we also have a film coming out in 2015. D.A. Pennybaker, who won a Lifetime Oscar in 2012, and his wife and fellow filmmaker Chris Hegedus have been following us around for 3 years. They've had complete access to everything that we do. Whenever they want to film us, they do. And all those hundreds and hundreds of hours of filming is going to be boiled down to a 90-minute or so film that should come out sometime in 2015.
That's good news too. I'm sure it'll be very, very powerful.
They're going to have to Photoshop me.
Oh, well, I'm glad you still have a sense of humor, because you've been working for decades doing some very difficult work that moves very slowly, unfortunately.
Well, it's now begun to move a lot faster than it ever used to. It really has.
Good. Well, let's see some great action in New York. I can't wait to read.
Well, thank you for helping us spread the word. I appreciate it very much.
You're welcome, Steve. Keep doing it.
Okay.
Thanks for joining me, and all the best.
Okay. Okay, bye.
Okay, bye. That's all for this week. Have a very delicious week. I'm Karen Hartglass, and this has been It's All About Food. Bye-bye.